Reading this morning from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 4, texts. We'll see how far we get, but starting with text 6, probably through text 11. Little summary, these verses are their questions by Shaunaka, where he's exhibiting the qualifications of a receiver of the receiver of the full benefit of the message of Srimad Bhagavatam by his eagerness. He's asking specific questions of Sutta that lay out the rest of the chapter. So like this is like an index, because everything that follows is Sutta's answering, responding to the questions that we're reading this morning. It's highlighting the qualifications of Maharaj Parikshit also as a receiver of the message of the Bhagavatam. We know that Maharaj Parikshit achieved perfection of life simply from hearing the Shravanam process, the most fundamental process. He's our hero, our role model, emblem of here's what you need to do to get the full benefit of Srimad Bhagavatam, receiving it. So, some glories of Maharaj Parikshit are in a tight manner, little sutra manner, as they're presented. And then Shaunaka says, please describe more about this quality, that quality of Maharaj Parikshit. So that's what we're going to hear. And the further, the glorification of the Srimad Bhagavatam itself. Very neatly presented to us by Shaunaka's questions. So he wants to hear this because this is Srimad Bhagavatam. It's the glorification of the personality of Godhead. It's this very, very special literature. So, text 6 begins. Shaunaka is asking, how was Shukadeva Goswami, the son of Vyas, recognized by the citizens when he entered into the city of Hastinapur after wandering in the provinces of Kuru and Jangala, appearing like a madman, dumb and retarded? So nobody had seen him before. He was, you know, a total unknown personality. Not even seeing him grow up, because he grew up within the womb of his mother. Very unique arrangement. The sages had never seen him before, so the question was, how was he recognized? And specifically, he looked anything other than a sadhu. He looked like a dullard. He looked like a deranged person by external appearance. So Prabhupada takes that opportunity to explain that how a great personality can be understood is through their speaking. And in other places he's described like that. A person may be accepted by people in general as a great person, but you can really understand the person's position when they speak. He wants us to know it's not that somebody does some magic tricks. That is, they do some, manifest some mystic siddhi. And common people will go, wow, look at that. But one who has studied Srimad Bhagavatam, especially with the guidance of Srila Prabhupada, will not go, "Wow, look at that." They'll say, "Let's hear what the person has to say." And we heard previously, yesterday morning, we were hearing, what is that qualification of speaking? It's speaking as one has heard it, according to the audience, time, place, circumstance, without adjusting principles, but suitable for the audience to understand. And that's what we're looking for. We're not looking for the other things. I had on the flight from Delhi back to America, it was American Airlines, that non-stop thing that goes from Delhi to Chicago. And the whole group of stewardesses had just gone to see Amma, the Mama Hugs lady. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they all, because I was dressed as I'm dressed, they, each one of them had to have a little conversation with me to kind of like check me out. And I came to know that there was one stewardess out of the group that was her, she said her teacher. She didn't say guru, she said her teacher or her guide or something like that. So she wanted to go, so the other ladies out of curiosity went with her. And so one of them said that they had gone, and I asked, you know, what was the experience like? She looked at me and said, "I didn't feel anything." She hugged me and I didn't feel anything. Because she had heard, "Oh, you're going to feel something." And I was thinking of Prabhupada's instructions here, that what's the standard of someone who's... So we had, in the discussion, I didn't say directly, "Let's hear," I just said, that a mode of goodness, very loving person is always a nice association. But what's the goal? The goal is to reach Krishna. The goal is to understand Krishna. Because that, and how do you understand Krishna and reach Krishna? Through devotional service. So that would promote devotional. So if something promotes the quality of goodness, she said, "Don't worry, I'm a Christian. I believe in Jesus Christ, and I wasn't moved from that position. I wasn't going there to get moved from that position." But it was interesting, her comment she made was, particularly the Western ladies in the audience, they all seemed very serene, very, very happy. That was nice. The mode of goodness is nice. Is that us? Okay. The mode of goodness is nice. But the Bhagavatam's message is beyond the mode of goodness. And so the next verse describes the Srimad Bhagavatam as Sattvati Shrutihi. Sattvati, Prabhupada is translated as transcendence or Vishuddha Sattva. It's a transcendental literature. So this, the standard of acceptance of a sadhu, how do we know who is a sadhu? Not how long their beard is. It's not how many mystic performances they can exhibit. It's lots of things that it's not. Not how, what you feel when they hug you. It's that the message of transcendence is can be transparently imparted, because this is our Vedic process. The Vedic process is based on Shabda Brahman, spiritual sound. And the purest form of that spiritual sound, according to the literatures themselves, is this Srimad Bhagavatam, Sat Vatam Patihi, or here, Sat Viti Shruti. Those who are situated in transcendence find attraction there. Or say it the reverse, those that are not attracted to anything of the modes of nature are attracted to this Srimad Bhagavatam, and it attracts the heart of even those who are attracted to the modes of nature, to the position of transcendence. It's that kind of literature. And so, what is the qualification of a sadhu? This is a theme throughout this first canto. How do you detect? What's the standards? Their smile, their charisma, their tricks, the mystic feats, that is. It's the transparent representation of the message of Srimad Bhagavatam. Another thing they don't do, the Prabhupada is saying here, is they don't pander to the whims of ordinary citizens. So what do the ordinary citizens want? Let's supply that, and then I'll be accepted as a nice sadhu. But that's not the standard. The standard is knowing what the message of transcendence is, presenting it in an appropriate manner to the audience, and drawing their attention to transcendence. Now, in the case of Shukadeva Goswami, he appeared, because he was in the transcendental position, he wasn't behaving according to norms of society. He was behaving apparently like an avaduta. In fact, we're going to find out more detail in the 19th chapter. When he came into the assembly, he was just walking along, stark naked, or clothed by the four directions, and the children and ladies were following behind him, taunting him, saying funny things, teasing him, and he was not responding. So they thought, wow, this guy's a madman. And they were laughing and making fun of him. Until Shukadeva Goswami walked into the assembly of the sages, and because of their spiritual acumen, they could immediately understand who he was. And they stood. They all stood. And the children and ladies were making fun of this person. They're all, the sages are respecting. Although he's just a young boy, 16 years old. So the question asked is, how did the citizens of Hastinapur recognize him? They recognized him by his spiritual presence, and more significantly by his speaking. A sage is not recognized by sight, but by hearing, Prabhupada writes. Again, you'll hear this theme throughout Canto 1. How to recognize a sadhu, how to receive a sadhu, the type of questions that one places before a sadhu, what's the message of a sadhu. The sadhu's message cuts right through the the worldly message. I wish I could remember right now. Rabindra Srup was describing, not that describing, he was giving a word for word, like of when Prabhupada arrived at the airport in New York. It was a time when they didn't have Transportation Security Administration. People could go all the way down to the gate to receive, so you know, the whole temple, and from devotees from all over the place would go to the gate and have kirtan in the middle of the airport hall when Prabhupada came. It was an uproar. And then there was a reporter who had come. Somehow he knew that Prabhupada was going to arrive. And Prabhupada, he asked Prabhupada a question. I wish I could remember. Something about, you know, is this a form of Buddhism? Just like, you know, typical innocent reporter type question. And Prabhupada's answer was, you know, right to the core of the response. You know, he could give a nice social response that one often does, I often do. Just, you know, this is Krishna consciousness. This is Hare Krishna. People ask that all the time. Are you a monk? Are you a Buddhist? Say, no. Hare Krishna. Can you say that? Hare Krishna. Oh, Hare Krishna. So they know. Oh, Hare Krishna. But Prabhupada didn't give that kind of response. He something. Gee, it was a transcendental response. Nice, but very nice. Something like, we have nothing to do with them, and this is speaking about God. We're come to give the message of God, and something about what is the message. And then Prabhupada gave the answer and said, "Are you ready to accept?" Something just like. Whew, I forget exactly. Another one was when some reporter came to interview Prabhupada, and she was wearing a mini skirt, and she asked Prabhupada, "Swamiji, why do you shave your head?" He said, "To keep one's head cool. Better to have a cool head than cold legs." Because he spoke like that because her mood was challenging. So, how did it happen that the great sage, Maharaj Parikshit met this great sage? So we've heard about Maharaj Parikshit, Shukadeva Goswami, the sadhu, and how did it come to pass that the two met? Maharaj Parikshit, Shukadeva Goswami. So, of course, he narrates that as the response. That will come later in this canto. Making it thus possible for this great transcendental essence of the Vedas, Bhagavatam, to be sung by him. So, we're hearing about the glory of Srimad Bhagavatam and the meeting of the two personalities. In the purport, Prabhupada calls the Srimad Bhagavatam Shuka Samhita. And in the text, it's Satvati Shrutihi, the transcendental essence of the Vedas. And three times, essence of the Vedas, essence of the Vedas, in the purport. Essence of the Vedas, as opposed to what some people consider it to be modern, fanciful creation from poetic authors. The essence of the Vedas, Satvati Shrutihi, spoken by this most qualified person. Why is Shukadeva Goswami going to speak, you know, fanciful stories of a poet? He has no interest. He would not. Shukadeva Goswami was accustomed to stay at the door of a householder only long enough for a cow to be milked. And he did this just to sanctify the residence. So this is another feature of a sadhu, in this case Shukadeva Goswami. We're going quickly back and forth between Maharaj Pariksit's qualities and Shukadeva Goswami's qualities because there are role models here, the perfect speaker, the perfect receiver of the message of Bhagavatam. So Shukadeva Goswami as the speaker, he was truly detached. He was truly detached. And so why did he go to a householder's home long enough to receive milk from them, long enough for the cow to be milked? The point that Prabhupada makes in the purport is not as his means of livelihood and maintenance, but he should come, the sadhu should understand their purpose in coming is to give. You've probably all heard this comment that Prabhupada made one time very early in the movement. He was in Berkeley. And at the university, he was giving a lecture, and at the end of the lecture, one young Indian student at Berkeley stood up, not just raised his hand, but stood up and challenged Prabhupada in a very challenging way. Swamiji, why have you come here to the West as a beggar? Very insulting. And immediately Prabhupada responded, I have not come as a beggar, I have come as a giver. You have come as a beggar. Why have you come here for your studies? You've come here to grovel at the feet of Western people and take their job. Only if you get a job from them will you be able to be maintained. I've come here to give the richness of Vedic culture to the whole world. I've come as a giver, not as a beggar. He repeated it many times. So our mission, certainly as renounced members of our society, but even other members of our society, our interest in interacting with people is not to get something from them. Our interest is to give something to them. I didn't make the point last night at the spiritual economics presentation, but I plan to do that at the Festival of Inspiration. I'm going to take the same topic and expand it a little bit into two parts. And part of the theme is going to be the economics of giving, because consumer economics is the economics of accumulation. And spiritual economics is the economics of giving. And that's how devotees, whether householders or renounced ashram, should see their role in society as giving, giving, giving. And we go to visit someone that's not a devotee, it's not to flatter them, like Prabhupada is saying here, so that they will give us some money. Our business is to give. One man, just like Prabhupada describes it, one man was sharing with me, literally, what his experience was like when he had somebody visit his business. You know, he didn't want to lose track of what was going on with his business, so a member of the temple had come to his home, had come to his business, and he said, I just wanted to get this fellow out of here as quickly as possible, because didn't want to lose track of business. So I told the secretary, take him, give him a check, and, you know. That was his mentality. Now, because of that service, this gentleman is now, he's a regular visitor at the temple. He's not a sadhaka. He's not like even really elevated in his consciousness. But that act of giving was helpful for him. Although his mentality wasn't very nice. Right? Because, piety, give him some, get out of here. I'm going to focus on making money. when Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, it's in his biography, he was invited by one very wealthy person to come, a king or something like that, wealthy landholder at least, and he was invited to come and speak because he had the practice of inviting brahmanas and saintly persons to come and speak their message. So he invited Bhaktisiddhanta to come. And the advisor to this wealthy person, the minister of the king or the advisor of the aristocratic landholder, was envious. He was afraid, oh my goodness, if Bhaktisiddhanta speaks, then I'll be like a firefly before the sun. So he spoke some negative things to this wealthy person about Bhaktisiddhanta. And so the wealthy person didn't make an arrangement for Bhaktisiddhanta to speak. And so when it came time for meals, Bhaktisiddhanta refused to eat and went on for 3 days. He fasted for 3 days, and when it was time to leave, he left. He was walking to the train station, wouldn't even take a ride. And he wasn't like angry, but the wealthy person went running after him without conveyance. He went running after him and said, Swamiji, you haven't eaten anything and you're walking to the train station. And Bhaktisiddhanta's very simple statement is, I how could I receive some sustenance from you without giving? I came to give. Without having that opportunity to give, how can I receive anything? And he continued fasting. It wasn't like, oh yeah, well, you're going to be like this, so I'm going to be like that. That wasn't his mood. His mood was like it's being described here. When a sadhu visits the place of a householder, it's not, if the mentality is, this is a good way that I can maintain myself, that's abominable. It's disqualification, put it milder, for being able to deliver anything of value. The consciousness of, this is a practical arrangement to maintain ourselves. And so, it's terrible. And we should be wary of that mentality. Sometimes there's contemplation in our society. Should we do this kind of puja or that kind of something, because then people will come forward and give some contribution with the rationale that that will be good for them if they give some contribution. But they should, don't pander to the whims of ordinary people that think, I want some material benediction, so we'll do this, that, and the other thing, and they receive something and we use it in Krishna's service. That's not the instruction. It's not the training that we've gotten from Prabhupada's writings. We have no business with householders, save and except to enlighten them in transcendental knowledge. And if in the course of that there's some asking of alms, let's say for a person in the renounced order, the asking or receiving of our going, like Madhukari, it's not maintenance. It's a way of engaging people and speaking transcendental messages. The giving must be the quality of a sadhu. So, what's the quality of a sadhu? They're giving. And in a broader sense, sadhu means devotee. Not just those who are wearing saffron. It's a devotee. We're being trained to be sadhus. Wherever we go, we're giving. In the workplace, it's a protection. If you're thinking in the workplace, how can I give Krishna consciousness to other people here in the workplace? thinking like that is protection from all the rubbish stuff that goes on, what they're eating and speaking and, you know, their meditation upon all kinds of things, mundane and abominable. So that's contaminating influence for a devotee. But if the devotee is thinking how to give Krishna consciousness to these people, immediately there's, if the mood of Lord Chaitanya's giving of Krishna consciousness, even if you don't actually, you know, perform the act, if the contemplation is there sincerely, Krishna will make some opportunities, some doors will be opened. But thinking like that is protection. It's how a sadhu lives their life. A person that's a devotee of the Lord lives their life. And specifically now for a renounced person, visiting the home of a householder, it's the purpose is to sanctify the home. And the householder should think like that. This is very fortunate. Someone has come, sadhu has come to the home. Our home is sanctified just by the presence. And then the how to receive a sadhu is also part of the message. Of course, in this case, it's Maharaj Prikshit receiving Shukadeva Goswami. Or like Grandfather Bhishma, when he received all the sages and personalities who came at the time of his departure, and particularly Lord Krishna. So and then you go completely to the other side, and that is nice warning that the sadhu that goes to the householder's home should not think, oh, this is very nice. Maybe I could also enjoy like this. Maybe I'm missing out on something. Prabhupada, not here but elsewhere, speaks that if one thinks like that, that is, it's instant contamination. So, the protection purpose is giving Krishna consciousness. And when that mood is there, with proper training, then one can see, factually speaking, all of the complications that are there in the life of a householder because of their attachments. And so that the sadhu's business is to lift from that attached position. That's the duty, that's the role. Text number 9. It is said that Maharaj Prikshit is a great first class devotee of the Lord, and that his birth and activities are all wonderful. Please tell us about them. That's a nice question. That makes up 3 chapters of this canto to give the answer. Coming towards the 16, 17, and 18, those chapters of the first canto is responding to this. So he's hinting at, why is there interest? He's a first-class devotee. Devotee means it's in relation to Krishna. Why is there interest in the birth of somebody and the activities of somebody in this world? No interest, except that he's a devotee. And so the devotee means in relation to Krishna, so there's interest. There's another reason why it's of interest. In addition to whatever is going to be spoken is in relation to Krishna. He's not only a great devotee, he's the grandson of the Pandavas, who are the Lord's eternal associates wherever he performs his activities in this world. That's clearly in relation to Krishna. But also he's our exemplar. He's our acharya in how we should hear the Srimad Bhagavatam and live our life in relation to the message of Srimad Bhagavatam. So hearing very carefully about our exemplar, it then tells us how to translate those principles into our life. It gives us inspiration. So everything about Maharaj Prikshit's life was extraordinary. even before he was born. So that's described coming up in chapter 7. The Brahmastra of Ashvatthama, and how he was saved by Krishna. Then his birth ceremony, whole chapters given to describing the qualities during his Namakarana. The astrologers are giving description of the qualities of his life. Then his activities, his prowess as a king, when the personality of Kali was breaking the legs of the bull, came at once, ready to kill him, with his sword raised, powerful. This is, you know, this is the virtue of this Maharaj Parikshit. During the entire time that he was hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, mention is made here in the purport, that he didn't eat anything, he didn't drink anything, he didn't sleep. I mean, we can't do that. We can't not eat anything, not drink anything, and not sleep. Got to do at least one of those things, if not two or three. But, you know, what is his qualification? Even before, you know, receiving Shukadev Goswami's message, he's up there. So what do? We follow his example. We try to qualify ourselves. Prabhupada ends, everything about Maharaj Parikshit is wonderful, and his activities are worth hearing attentively. Desire is expressed herein to hear about him in detail. This is Shonaka. It's not casual. He's very eager. Then a little bit of detail, probing into his activities. Text 10. He was a great emperor and possessed all the opulences of his acquired kingdom. He was so exalted that he was increasing the prestige of the Pandu dynasty. Why did he give everything up to sit down on the bank of the Ganges and fast until death? Prabhupada comments, it's astonishing. He rightfully, religiously, lawfully acquired a kingdom. It was just given to him. His kingdom was the whole world, and all the opulences of that kingdom were his, the king. And he was so powerful as a Kshatriya that there was there were no rogues and rascals. They were afraid of the power of Maharaj Parikshit. So they behaved. And everyone loved him in the king. So, and he just walked away and gave it up. Astonishing. This opulence of renunciation was invoked by something. What was that something? How did this happen? He was such a great emperor that all his enemies would come and bow down at his feet and surrender all their wealth for his own benefit. He was full of youth and strength, and he possessed insuperable kingly opulences. Why did he want to give up everything, including his life? So, not like Maharaj Parikshit was suicidal or something. But he was detached, is the idea. Describe this. So he, of course, we know he considered himself to be an offender, and he had offended a brahmana, and in such a manner that the son of that brahmana cursed him to die, and he considered, this is right, to offend a brahmana. I deserve it. I deserve worse. So, I accept. So it's not like hey, let me go and try to pacify this little boy, and maybe, you know, something can be worked out here. Just accept it. There's the plan of the Lord. This is just. I accept. So that resignation to not invest consciousness in neutralizing the affairs of duality so it feels better. If there's something that's very clearly coming as a result of past wrong activity, accept it. Invest consciousness in this one primary activity, fixing the mind upon the personality of Godhead. That's what he wanted to do. That's Maharaj Pariksit. That's our exemplary character that we can understand. Where is there that situation in the day-to-day life in this world that there's no disturbance? I mean, there's probably some days in our lives that have passed where there's no disturbance, but most of the days I can remember there's some disturbance. And how do you fix your mind when there's some disturbance? It's where you see there's value, and even, you know, the resolution to how the duality is configuring itself is not resolved by control and manipulation and cleverness. It's resolved by Krishna. By Krishna making a clear path how to make this all possible. How to, whatever is the arrangement, how to keep oneself fixed in Krishna consciousness at all times. This is how a devotee needs to be trained, above duality. Not elated when there's something good fortune, disturbed when there's ill fortune. We're swiftly approaching Ram Nomi, and so many examples like that in Ram's Leela, when he was told, prepare to become crowned prince regent. Yes, father. Go to the forest. Yes, father. This, you know, Narayana Paraksarge Nakutaschana Bibhuti Svaraga Apavarga Narakeshu. This Apituyarta Darshanam. This being fixed because of Narayana Parayana. Being fixed in the personality of Godhead. Attaining that goal. Whatever duality is happening, that doesn't make or break reaching the goal. There's not, the impetus is not the material circumstance. The impetus is our desire to reach Krishna. And the medium of reaching Krishna is the medium of devotional service. We can serve Krishna this way, we can serve Krishna that way. That's the transcendentalist. That's our Maharaj Pariksit example. And so many other personalities as examples. The transcendental message is fully received, and our mission is transcendental. And things adjust themselves by Krishna's arrangement. So any discussion?
I want the last, the point of fixing ourselves in, you know, in this Krishna consciousness properly. Like for me, this is the thing which I've been oscillating for some time. I sometimes like chanting early in the morning, but then it loses, and the round goes towards the end of the day. Somehow I've been hearing that in the morning we have to fix this, but somehow I keep oscillating. Like, is something missing? I'm not sure what is missing.
You just what you just said is straight from Madhurya Kandambani in the Anishtita Bhakti stage. There are, one of the characteristics of unsteadiness in devotional service is having a clear understanding of something that will help to improve devotional service, taking clear vows to improve that which will help us become stronger in Krishna consciousness, and it doesn't happen. It's just a stage of unsteady bhakti, anishtita bhakti. And the cause is some anartha of the heart. It's not something out there, it's something over here. And so what to do? That's the... With faith, you continue to persevere, relying upon Krishna. So here's a little seedling that's got started to grow and it's got a few leaves and is thinking, I want some flowers. Just has to grow some more. Keep the watering and the sunshine and the flowers will come. So that's utsahan nishchayat dhairyat. The dhairyat, the conviction, is in the process of bhakti itself. Because the process of bhakti will in fact carry me to that position, I just continue investing my determined effort with confidence in the process of bhakti, shuddha bhakti, and just stay there faithfully. Enthusiastic and patient. It's the enthusiasm that's based upon passion will subside if there isn't fruit. The enthusiasm that's based upon transcendence will not subside, whether there's fruit or not fruit. Not when there's fruit, okay, now I can relax, or there's not fruit, I give up. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with the relationship with Krishna. You had something over here?
Yes, Maharaj. Maharaj, my question is related to the accepting and giving theme that we discussed.
Okay.
A consistent message that I have been hearing is we need to accept first before even attempting to give. So, how can I understand that? How can I process that?
Well, it's not before you even attempt to give. That's not an exact statement, an exact representation of that. You can't give that which you don't have. So, but part of the act of receiving is opening the heart, and then when the heart is open, the gifts are already there. You know, in one sense, love of God is already there. So, the opening of the heart just to awaken that which is already there, and the giving. Let's just say, you know, in very early stages of Krishna consciousness, how Prabhupada engaged people is we went and performed Sankirtan. We were giving. That was also helping to open our hearts. We had, you know, we may have had a very mundane conception of what that is, what that giving is. You know, like an us and them kind of thing, or I'm better, you're lesser kind of thing, or the essence of it is just joyful. Being joyful and giving joyfulness. But the purification can come through acts of giving. But so the concentration initially is to receive the transcendental gift before you can fully, in essence, give the transcendental gift. But the activities of devotional service from the very beginning have components of receiving and giving. You know, like somebody serves prasadam. We're giving. A newcomer that doesn't even know anything can be engaged, and it's transcendental. You know, but the realization will not fully be there till they've really received the message of what prasadam is, what receiving the mercy of Krishna is. Does that help? We don't make a... What I'm saying here is we don't make a rigid line, don't give. But we... To give that which is transcendental, we have to receive it.
I have a follow-up on this.
Okay.
Like, just to make sure that I understand things properly. For example, like, if we are not in a capacity to give, can we take as following the instructions to be...
Sure. Okay. Sure. Sure. And this giving-taking is in a matter of the heart more than a matter of an external event. For the most part, my common experience is people of this world have not experienced loving relationships. They've experienced material, entrepreneurial type of relationships. But, you know, truly having experienced a loving relationship is very rare. And when persons come in contact with a loving relationship, they don't know how to relate to it. They don't know how to deal with it. They want to push it away or, like, turn it into something material or project upon it what it isn't. They don't know how to deal with it. So this is, this idea of receiving is receiving a loving relationship and having felt what a loving relationship is, oh, that's what it is. Experiencing it, then one can give it. But otherwise we're busy doing something else. Yeah.
Action, am I looking at the sadhu with a mundane vision? Because actually what sadhu has to offer is much, much more.
I think it depends upon your consciousness, your understanding of the person, the nature of, you know, if the purpose behind the question is material comfort, then it's not proper. If the spirit behind the question is so that I can effectively be more fixed in my Krishna consciousness, and this thing over here is unresolved, it's drawing my energy so I can't be fixed in my Krishna consciousness. Look at Prabhupada's example. He gave so many instructions, in day-to-day worldly affairs for his disciples so that they could be properly situated in Krishna consciousness. Now surely there were times when Prabhupada wouldn't respond to mundane questions saying, you know, what does this have to do with Krishna consciousness? And I take it that it was more the spirit of the person than it was the question itself. He would say sometimes, supposing you had an answer to this question, how is that going to enhance your Krishna consciousness? How is it going to help you reach the goal of life? Because the persons weren't thinking goal of life, they were thinking, you know, something else. Either trivia or challenge or something.
For a condition, someone who is material affected, his natural tendency would be like relief from material.
Yeah, that's what they're looking for. And then in the sadhu, it's very much dependent upon the circumstance and the individual and so on. The sadhu may just rip right through that. Say, you know, why are you wasting your energy on, you should be, and if you were doing more of the transcendence, you would, this would become very solvable. So you have a solution, and now what? Now you're still in mundane consciousness. So, but depends on the person and the circumstance and so on. The clarification is, when I use that phrase, that's what I mean. You know, others may have another sense of that, but what, he's repeating something he's heard from me, and I'm clarifying how I use that phrase. Go ahead.
Maharaj, so my understanding of that is, it's the feelings of gratitude that we have in our heart.
As a starting point. That's the receiving.
Which is the whole part of, I mean, that is the more important, and through that will flow the...
It's a seed. You say more important. It's a seed. The seed of gratitude grows into loving devotional service. Real gratitude, when felt, we discussed this yesterday, it what flows from that is you do something. You express that real gratitude is expressed, and it's expressed in word and in action, and in, you know, your whole demeanor, your mood, where there's real gratitude. And so how can there be real gratitude until you have actually received? So it's a matter of the heart. Okay? And then through receiving and then feelings of real gratitude, it takes devotional service off of the mechanical and onto the devotional platform, where one does things with feeling, not just you do things because some other, you know, it's good for me or motive goodness reasons, or I don't like to suffer so I'll do it, so that, those kinds of reasons, but on another platform.
I have a couple of questions. One was, can you tell us how it would feel to be in a loving relationship? I've heard that many times.
Uh-huh.
Like, what is a loving relationship? And other thing is, what does it mean to open one's heart?
Well, what does it mean to open one's heart is like what your husband asked. It's receiving. It's not, so it's not, one can learn a lot about life from children. When it's even in very simple exchanges with children, you can immediately tell a lot about the character of that child by, you know, the nature of the interactions. And in many cases, it's all about themselves. They're very narcissistic. It's just their senses and their happiness, and something comes and something goes, and it's all selfish. That's very common. But then there are children, even if they're selfish, if you make deposits on, you know, in a very personal way, I've had this experience over time, because the children, when they grow up, they report it back. When their hearts are open, they come and share. Because although they're acting like little, still selfish machines, they're in their heart, they're picking up on, here's a gesture of genuine care, and it's genuine because it's consistently coming. Even if I'm naughty, even if I'm inattentive, even if I'm wild, even if I'm all over the place. So it just, that's slowly an opening of the heart. So where is that going to come from, you know, for that child to receive that? It's got to be from someone that is unconditional in their giving. Because their consciousness is not on the behavior part, their consciousness is on the soul. So one can deal with the behavior part, but one also needs to deal with the soul. And that's where the loving exchange comes. And receiving it is what that child feels. Here's somebody that cares. Genuinely. And I've seen children will sometimes do something naughty and they'll look to see what are you going to do now. And sometimes they do it just for attention, because they're not getting loving attention, so they're misbehaved so they'll get attention. Because they want attention. They're little attention machines. So it's very taxing sometimes and challenging, and, you know, to be really creative to get past the behavior to the soul. So the opening of the heart is receiving that which is directed to the soul and receiving it, and, you know, the feelings that go with that act. I had a very nice experience. We had a Janmashtami program that a big part of it, the youth put on. It was in the suburbs in Chicago. And after the program, one 13, 14-year-old girl came up. You know, everybody's moving the chairs and doing stuff, and so she just came up and said, "I can remember coming to the temple when I couldn't even see the deities. I can remember my mom had to lift me up so I could see over the, you know, just see the deities. And my life has been the temple, growing up in the temple. And because some of the adults have shown care for us, we're now able to do, we can put on the program ourselves. We feel empowered, and, you know, it's like, I just want to say to you and to the others, thank you for helping us grow so we can give this Krishna consciousness to other people as we did since we were real little. And that's an opening of the heart. You know, This is not like one of the core, kind of like in one of the quiet, peripheral little children that just kind of watches everybody and does something every now and then. But they were, you know, although they were little, they were appreciating, they were noticing and appreciating. And so that's in their heart. So what's going to come out? Devotional service with feeling. So now they're not just performances, but feelings, outpourings of those feelings. That's what opening of the heart means. And then one can give it with feeling. So my response was, so now that you, thank you for sharing that with me, now that you feel that, you see the little ones? You do the same for them. You try to give to them what you've been given. So it's like apprenticeship, right? Right away, I understand, Maharaj, and we're doing that. It's one of the things I like about my friends is they take care of the little ones just like they're us. Because there is this thing with children that we're older. And the little ones say, you know, we feel accepted by the older ones. And how does that happen? You break down this us and them, competition, we're better, we're older, whatever it is. That breaks down when they've received a loving exchange and they're filled. They're feeling full. They don't need to get into that competition stuff. They can feel they want to give what they've received. That's like a miracle in training children. And then there's the big children, like all of you. That also need that experience of receiving loving exchange, opening the heart and receiving it. And then, what does that feel like? Now, what do you do with it? So kind of answered the first question too, but just even more specifically, experiencing of loving relationship means to start with opening the heart, but recognize what it is. Where is this coming from? It's not something mundane. Because something mundane always has a purpose behind it, and you feel it. They want something. It's a business deal. What's the deal? But if there's nothing behind it, but giving, that's like, well, what's that? It's a loving gesture. There's no condition behind it. Wow. Well, how do I respond to that? Well, it starts with you feel it, then you express what those feelings are in the form of words or in the form of actions or what you do with your life. And that's a guiding principle of whatever you do with your life, whatever words or actions and paths you follow and how you conduct yourself with others, that light is always on. And it's a principle that you want to grow and manifest in other relationships as it's appropriate, socially and, you know, interpersonally and so on. I'll take it one step further and just make a personal statement that I've been speaking over the past year and a half. That is, a concern that the unity of our Hare Krishna movement continues in the future. So, in quick steps, when Prabhupada was present, unity was preserved by Prabhupada's presence. When there was disunity, Prabhupada brought unity just by his presence. And then he left physically. And after his physical departure, what has, to whatever degree there's been some unity, it's been the experience of those who serve Prabhupada and their faith that they have in Prabhupada and making all kinds of sacrifice for the sake of that faith they have in Prabhupada. Now, go out further over time and Prabhupada disciples are gone with that direct, first-hand experience no longer accessible. What's going to preserve the unity of that which Prabhupada created? My conviction is it's loving relationships with devotees where there's common experience, like, you know, the Penn State group has, there's a camaraderie amongst the devotees who, even they've graduated and gone off and done something, there's a sense of, there's a common experience and some bonding, and it's not that each one of you are pure devotees, but you have deep respect and regard for one another while recognizing there may be shortcomings, whatever. There's that common experience. So that's nice. So there's loving relationships. At least to some degree, there's loving relationships. Now let's go to the whole world, like what Bhaktivedanta Maharaj said. What happens if our experience here in Russia is the Russian experience, and then the China experience is the China experience, and then there's that South America, and all over the world we're doing things in a different way with a different set of experiences, and we don't have loving relationships, what's going to happen? Standards are going to change, the unity is going to be lost. Go out over time. And it's going to be not like we know it today. So what's going to hold it together? To the degree it's held together, it's that there's devotees learn how to situate themselves in loving relationships. I'm thinking that's going to be my message when I the next couple Sunday feast programs that I speak about. We need to learn how to experience loving relationships with one another. Besides, we want it for the sake of Prabhupada's mission in this world. It's going to preserve it. But there are challenges. You know, we're defensive, we're insecure, we've been cheated, so many things. We're impersonal, we're selfish, a lot of obstacles. But the mission is very, very clear to me. And so, with those that can understand about loving relationships, energy needs to go there, and I specifically feel that leaders need to get together on that platform and show by example this is what a loving relationship looks like, and this is what it feels like, and how beautiful it is. And the next generation of those who are leaders need to be imparted that same message and carry it forward. And there may be a leader over there, and we're a leader over here, and how to respect and establish a loving relationship, because when there's loving relationships, you can easily work things out. In this material world, there's always problems, and problems divide. So how to address problems? Resting upon a loving relationship. Big challenge. And I, to the degree that it's there, we'll have unity within ISKCON. To the degree that it's not there, we'll have disunity. It'll break apart. I mean, when I go back to my room and, you know, start doing my thing, part of my thing is this. You know, addressing problems in such a way it's done with dignity and respect, and that where love is shown, but sometimes love means you take a hard position, but it's clear to the other person. That Prabhupada taught this with children. Discipline should be based on love and trust. So we have some very thoughtful members of our society who are thinking how to, when discipline is needed. Just happened last night before he took rest. Somebody's done something really bad, and they were like, nothing happened, but no, they did something really bad. So now they're acknowledging they did something really bad because there's a lawsuit, there's a gun to their head if they don't. So, but the person doesn't want to pull the trigger. They just want them to acknowledge they did something really bad. Now to work it out. So now it's not just, okay, dismiss the person. But what about, you know, now how is that person, who is actually, they did something bad, but they're not a terrible person. They should feel that they're being cared for. How to help them move on to a, you know, restored position. So that's like revolutionary. In this kind of just, you know, next. So we're learning how to be more mature. Even when giving discipline, to extend oneself in a loving manner. It's like with a child. Telling no to a child is easy, but establishing a loving relationship with the child is a challenge. How to say no where the child understands it's loving. It can't be, you know, by tricks. It has to be loving. It's a wonderful challenge. How to establish loving relationships. How to receive a loving relationship as a good starter. And then how do you respond to that? How do you give back? Seeing the problem and the solution is one thing. Making it manifest, that's very challenging. It has to come from a loving heart. It can't be, you know, charades. It has to be the real thing. And consistently the real thing. And based upon our pure teachings of devotion to Krishna, not some, you know, blind kind of sentiment. There's standards that we have to uphold. How do we do that? And then our, like Bhakti Trumarja's recent words is, we've been given a mission by Srila Prabhupada through the words of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that In every town and village, the holy name of the Lord should spread. Whew. We got a lot of work. And it's not just, you know, spread and okay, move on. It's all of the pain and suffering that people have been through and all of that stuff, because as soon as you bring somebody into Krishna consciousness, they bring all of that with them. You know, their hurt experiences of life and their bad association and, you know, so many things. It's major in this age of Kali. Major. So at least, you know, the training should be, this is my message this morning, the training of our devotees needs to be at least one by one, you know, as we deal with one another in this sangha of devotees, how to connect with the gift that Srimad Bhagavatam wants to give us, the awakening of our dormant Krishna consciousness, which means a loving relationship with Krishna, how to receive that gracefully and act upon it, and then share it with others, despite the complexities of life. So now, this, you know, when we address the complexities, it's in that context. And it's okay. Because that's just part of the overall mission. It's okay to approach a sadhu about the complexities, provided it's really clear where's, and it's not just so I have relief, thanks a lot, see you later. It's, you know, so that the mission can be furthered. The mission of loving Krishna and sharing loving devotional service unto Krishna with others, so that can go on unimpeded by this material complication. Then approaching the sadhu is fine with that particular concern. And the sadhu will know how to assist. I'm thinking now of just hearing Ramayana this morning. Sagar, King Sagar, was approached. He did austerities and was given the benediction by Bhrigu that although he had no sons, his two wives would have. He was very pleased by the austerities and sacrifices he had done. His two wives would have children. And one would have one son, the other would have 60,000 sons. But the one son would continue the line, and the other 60,000 sons would. So, it looks like, you know, it's just material stuff. But it's because the mission was to serve the Lord, it had its appropriate place, or Rishi Sringa, who made an arrangement for Dasarath to have his four sons. So that the consciousness behind the working out of the complexities of life is what's really important. It's to get to the place where we can have, and then we demonstrate our gratitude by in fact doing that, by from our hearts, committing ourselves to the standard of pure devotional service and sharing that pure devotional service with others. Okay, I think I'm going to end with that. Thank you very much.